You are tuned in to the NTD Broadcast Network presentation of Off Camera with Sam Jones. The best conversations happen off camera.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones. And in this episode, I sit down with writer, director, producer, Judd Apatow. What kid tells himself, I know being a high school loner who reads comic books all the time will pay off for me. One who winds up being a loner who reads comic books all the time. Or one who winds up creating iconic comedies like Freaks and Geeks, Superbad, and most recently, This Is 40. Enamored with comedy and comedians as a grade schooler, Apatow set about interviewing his idols for WKWZ. The first thing he learned is that they're kind. No one kicked him out when they realized WKWZ was a high school radio station. While his comedies and the actors in them are household names, most fans are unaware that they're the beneficiaries of a filmmaking approach Apatow is largely credited with developing. Fueled by self-doubt, or maybe just any comedian's compulsive search for the ultimate killer line, Apatow shoots and tests multiple versions of almost every scene he films. His true genius may be his knack for identifying new and often unlikely talent and letting it inform his scripts. This approach has elevated not only the films themselves, but the careers of James Franco, Lena Dunham, Seth Rogen, Melissa McCarthy, and Steve Carell, to name only a few. Perhaps due in part to his own painfully geekish childhood, he continues to remake Freaks and Geeks in work that lays bare our foibles, anger, lunacy, and occasional transcendence. At once eviscerating and empathetic, he holds a mirror up to us and we laugh in recognition. Apatow has seen us naked and we don't mind. Off Camera sits down with the crazy voice in all of our heads for an in-depth interview. So pull up a chair and listen in.
All right, Judd Apatow, thanks for coming. Thanks for doing this.
It's good to be here.
I appreciate it. And it's nice to just have someone here from the neighborhood.
That's right.
One thing I want to go straight into is, based on a lot of the material that you've done over the, you know, over your career, there's a lot of it that really connects to coming of age stuff in a lot of different ways, even if that's at different stages in a man's life.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you can still kind of remember what it felt like for you to be in high school.
At some point I can't tell if I remember it or I'm remembering versions from TV shows that we wrote about it or influenced by it. I mean, for me, you know, high school was a traumatic time. My parents got divorced and they never really figured it out. They didn't like get divorced, work it out, and then it's like they were fighting all through high school. I don't think they actually were officially divorced till I was in college. So a lot of high school was this kind of drama that was going on from, like, you know, seventh grade, you know, through the whole thing. So in my head I thought, like, oh, I gotta get a job. I have to figure out what I'm gonna do because this doesn't feel like a stable situation. Both my parents were, you know, very nice, but, you know, I was kind of seeing people in this, you know, combat. And I thought, okay, so, like, my kids probably think, well, whatever happens, I can, you know, sleep at dad's house.
Right.
But I never felt that, you know, I didn't have that sense of, like, this is a fallback position. It was more like, oh, you better get ready. You better figure out what you're going to do.
Were you very middle class?
Well, we started out probably kind of upper middle class, and then we kind of probably, like, slowly, you know, went down a little bit. You know, in my community, you know, it was very nice middle class, and then everyone's parents would get divorced and they would move into condos.
Right.
You know, so one by one, like, you know, you'd have a friend and then they would tell you, oh, we're going to move into Fairhaven Estates. Oh, your parents got divorced. And,
really?
And so that's good. I mean, literally person by person, by the end of high school, I didn't have one friend whose parents hadn't gotten divorced at that time.
Really?
And it was, you know, the 70s, and it was the beginning of the self-help era, and, you know, one day you're home and you see your erogenous zones laying around and you think, uh-oh, my parents are thinking about their feelings. This can't be good.
Were you in high school, were you an observer, or were you right in the thick of it? I mean, I guess I'm wondering, I see such a, you know, such a find level of observation of your characters. And I wonder if that was you as a kid. Were you withdrawn and watching other kids, or were you right in the thick of it?
I was kind of in the middle. You know, I wasn't an athlete. That seemed to be the thing that defined high school and you know, elementary school. Everything was that there was a lot of sports being played. And if you were bad at sports, it just kind of ruined everything. You know, because every day in elementary school, they played, you know, softball at lunch or soccer. And so if there was like gym class and at lunch, everyone played sports.
Right.
And you were bad at it. So you had this kind of like multi, you know, times a day humiliation in front of everybody. You know, you'd be like, you know, I was always put in like right field when they played. In right field, no one was a lefty.
Exactly.
Nothing came, you know, being put in right field was like being told you're not in the game.
Right.
And that was a big part of it for me, because it kind of defined your masculinity and just where you were in the pecking order. So I was just more into like comic books and Saturday Night Live and Monty Python, and I had my own set of interests, and there was no one to share it with. There wasn't like another kid who wanted to read Fantastic Four comic books with me or talk about Steve Martin on Saturday Night Live. I was the only one.
Oh, no kidding.
You know, so it was just a real kind of private hobby. And in the back of my mind, I thought, well, no one's into this now, but I know this is cooler than being good at softball. And I know this can lead to something, and one day this will pay off for me. But I'm going to have to really ride this out for a long time. So I had some hope, because I liked comedians, and I liked people who were doing interesting things. And I thought, man, if I could be Jerry Seinfeld, that'd be a great life, and it'd be way cooler than like being the catcher.
Sure.
But it might take me another 15 years to figure it out, and I was oddly patient about it.
Interesting. So was wanting to be funny and be a comedian and be in that world, was it equal parts wanting a future, or did you get a buzz from being funny too? Like, did you have a moment where you're like, oh, I like that feeling of being funny?
Well, I think a lot of, you know, my parents were, you know, funny both on purpose and not on purpose. And, you know, my grandfather was very funny, and my grandma was friends with this comedian Toadie Fields when I was a kid, so I was exposed a little bit to the idea of what a comedian did. But I think a lot of it came from just feeling like everything was bullshit, and I was just so annoyed, like, oh, this is the setup of how it works with kids and social order and power and teachers. And so from very early on, even from, you know, second, third grade, I was fascinated by the Marx Brothers, because I liked them, because they told everybody to fuck off, basically.
Right, right.
You know, hey, here's the rich guy. He's a fucking idiot. You know, here's the rich, pretty woman who treats us, you know, like dog shit. And now we're going to make her life a living hell. And I, on some level, even as like a 10-year-old, got into that. Like, okay, so even like Duck Soup, which is all about, you know, the government,
sure,
and war, you know, as a little kid on some level, I liked the idea that someone was saying, like, all of these systems, all these bureaucracies don't know what they're doing, and we're going to humiliate them by being funny and pointing it out. And I must have felt that way about what was happening at school, what was happening in my house, my family not getting along. Like, oh, all these people that tell me what to do don't know what they're talking about, and they're in chaos. And so I like George Carlin or Richard Pryor, the people who like would point it out. Like,
so no, it was social commentary to you as much as it was like, it wasn't, hey, I'm more popular because I'm getting a laugh. It was,
no, it wasn't that, because I, you know, I was maybe, I mean, you might say I was kind of a class clown, but I was very shy and nervous. I wasn't very comfortable with myself. I'm still not really. And so I was not a super outgoing class clown, but I was a student of comedy, and I liked watching, you know, voluminous amounts of comedians and funny movies and reading everything about it. I couldn't, you know, when they have that book, like the Malcolm Gladwell book, where he talks about how you have to
10,000 hours.
The 10,000 hours, yeah. If you play tennis for 10,000 hours, you know, I mean, I put in like a million hours of studying.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. It's like woodshedding when you're a musician. Like, you have to kind of dig in, and you did that. You like learned Eric Clapton solos, that version of comedy.
Yeah, and not really knowing that's what I was doing. But I was going home and getting the TV Guide and highlighting who was on what talk show every night that week. Oh, okay, Michael Keaton's on Merv Griffin, and Leno's on Letterman, and I would, you know, make a point of watching it all, mainly for fun. I didn't really look at it as studying. I just couldn't get enough of it.
I've always been envious of that personality type that knows what they want to do from such a young age and is actually doing it. Like the Beatles, you know, they knew what they were doing and were doing it when they were 17. So yeah. I was like, yeah, of course they had 10 albums by the time they were 30.
Yeah.
But you were kind of that person, right? You knew it. You knew what you wanted. You were singular in your focus. Mm-hmm.
From about 10, probably. And then when I was, you know, 13, 14, really trying to act on it, you know, so I, you know, interviewed comedians from my high school radio station. I got a job as a dishwasher and a busboy at a comedy club because I just wanted to watch. You know, I most of the money I made went for the taxis that took me to the comedy club because it was really far from my house. But I got to be at this place, the Eastside Comedy Club on Long Island, and Rosie O'Donnell was performing there, and Eddie Murphy, and all these amazing comedians like Bob Nelson and Rob Bartlett. And I was able, you know, to watch when I was 14, 15 years old. And I never told anyone I wanted to be a comedian. Felt too humiliating,
right,
for
right.
The gall to say that. But then when I was a senior in high school, you know, I worked up the nerve to start doing open mic nights.
Did you ever have a plan B? Like, what if comedy fails? Did you?
I didn't, because I interviewed a bunch of comedians and they said it takes 7 years to find out what your comedy persona is and to get comfortable on stage. And so in my head, I thought, okay, well, I'm 17, so I'll be great at this when I'm 24.
So you're high school at a radio station, mm-hmm. And so you, when you did these interviews, did you tell people you were in high school?
Well, I created this show. It was WKWZ, Syosset High School's radio station, and it was an interview show with comedians. And sometimes people came to the radio station, but usually I would go, you know, to their apartments or to comedy clubs with like this really enormous tape recorder from the right. AV squad and. And most of the time, I just said I was from a radio station in New York, and I would show up and be 15 years old. And
so you're they like would, Cameron Crowe.
Yeah. And they were not, you know, they were always, it was very nice, but not necessarily thrilled to see a child show up at their door. But comedians are generally nice. So, and they would give me a lot of time. You know, I went and interviewed Jerry Seinfeld, and he talked to me.
So it wasn't on the phone, it was in person.
Somewhere on the phone. I interviewed Gary Shandling on the phone, and Father Guido Sarducci, Don Novello, and Harry Shearer. Loudon Wainwright, I interviewed on the phone when I was a kid. Howard Stern, this is like 83, 84. But usually I would, you know, go somewhere. And then I would just say to them, how do you do it? How do you write a joke? How do you get stage time? How do you, you know, how do you write a movie? How do you get jobs as an actor? It was really just for me. Most of it wasn't. I don't think anyone even listened to it on the radio. Probably no one ever heard it on the radio.
Right.
But it was just, you know, a way of sitting down with like your heroes and just saying, tell me exactly what happened to you and how I can apply it to me. And that information, I think, was priceless, you know, to get to sit down with Harold Ramis and have him walk you through his career. You know, it implants somewhere in your brain. You don't even know how it does, just in your unconscious somewhere. You know, there's all these stories, and as you have to make choices in your life, you apply that information.
Do you remember the first one?
Mm-hmm.
Set the scene the first time you did it.
I think the first one was Steve Allen. Steve Allen put out a couple of comedy albums,
sure,
which were phony phone calls he had made when he hosted The Tonight Show and from other shows. And they were hysterical. They were like really, really funny. I mean, him doing phony phone calls with Johnny Carson and Jerry Lewis, you know, star-studded phony phone calls. And I went to a hotel room with my friend, and, you know, he talked to us for an hour and a half. And it was crazy. And then I interviewed Sandra Bernhard, was one of the first ones back then, you know, which is like right after King of Comedy, Paul Reiser, and Leno. I mean, for me to sit down with, you know, Jay Leno in 1983, 84 was life-changing.
That's amazing. And you didn't just do a few, you did a whole bunch.
I did like 50 of them.
All while you were in high school?
Yeah, all over about 2 years. I interviewed almost every original writer from Saturday Night Live. I just kind of went through the list.
And did it get easier, you know, as you did some, you figured out like, oh, this is what I say to get the publicist to...
You know, when you've interviewed some people, you could say to the next person, oh, I just did Leno and Seinfeld, and then they suddenly allow you to interview Willie Tyler and Lester.
Right, exactly. Oh, well, Seinfeld did.
Yes.
And were they mostly nice to you?
Yeah, everybody was incredibly nice. And that's part of what had an impact on me, too, is, oh, you should be nice. You know, separate from the information. You know, if you're in high school and you kind of feel a little bit outside of what's happening, I mean, I wasn't like bullied or anything as a kid. I just felt kind of goofy and, you know, hadn't really found myself. And then you meet all these comedians, they're kind of cool. And you're like, I want to be part of this fraternity, whatever's happening here. Like, I like how Seinfeld's treating me and how he carries himself and, you know, how Leno's behaving. I want to be, a part of this. And they were all so kind and polite. It just, some part of you picks up on that. Like, oh, this is what an adult should act like.
You know, it seems so obvious, but yet I don't think anyone else has had the balls or the temerity to go and do that like you did. You know, Steve Martin talks about how you were, you know, you came on like a much more mature and also, from what I've heard of him, you weren't incredibly timid. You were like right to the point.
I love these guys. And so to get near any of them, I mean, if anyone was around, I mean, I would just... I would hunt them down to get around some of these people.
It's incredible.
And it was fun. In a little way, it was a hunt. Like, can I get to talk to Andy Kaufman? I couldn't get Andy Kaufman.
Right. Was he your goal?
He was the ultimate goal. Like, could I talk to Andy Kaufman? Because he was from Long Island. But he was wrestling down south, and I would call his manager's office, and they would say, we literally don't know where he is. We haven't heard from him in 3 months. He's wrestling down south.
And he was done with conventional life.
Well, he was just, I don't know, he was in that wrestling phase. I had my list and I would just, check them off, one by one. You know, there were certain people, like, you knew you couldn't get, like, oh, you're not going to get Letterman or Johnny Carson. So a lot of the people I interviewed weren't gigantic stars then, and they became gigantic stars later. So when I interviewed, Seinfeld and...
Right,
and,
you didn't and, have a TV show yet.
That
right.
was, you know, 7, 8, 9 years before the TV show. But they were my favorite comedians. It was almost who I thought deserved to be big stars. You know, I interviewed Gary Shandling, and he laid out his whole career for me. This is before he did any TV shows, and I asked him, what his goals were, and he said, I'd like to do a TV show where I play kind of a version of myself, and I have a few ideas about it. And every single thing he said he wanted to do in his career, he accomplished.
That's amazing. Now, do you remember any of the advice that they get? Like, did any of it stick with you to this point today, where you still, it still is a bit of a mantra,
Well, patience. Patience was the main thing they talked about, because, to be a comedian, you have to be bad for years, then slowly you're bearable, and then you get kind of funny, and then you get pretty good, and then, if you stick with it, you might hit a whole nother level. Say somebody like Louis C.K., who's been around for a while, and suddenly he becomes, one of the greats of all time. And I knew as a kid, that only happens because you stick with it and you have discipline about it over decades.
Right.
So to learn that lesson as a teenager, that was probably the most important lesson.
Uh-huh.
I think kids today think, it's going to happen overnight.
Or it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Right.
So, like, if it doesn't happen today, I guess I'm not good enough. But for someone to tell you, at best, if you work really hard, you're not going to be even good at this for 7 years. That just changed my clock. Even for being a screenwriter, being a director, everything is slower. No, I guess I'm going to get better the more I do this. And that's just the process of it. And so I remember I had a friend, I'm still friends with Mike Binder. And when I was really young, he was the first guy who was making a living writing screenplays. And he said to me, you know, I sold my 10th screenplay. I just, every time I finished a screenplay, I started another one. I didn't wait to sell it.
Oh, really?
I just started another one. So then his career took off on screenplay number 10. And that had a big effect on me because a lot of people will write one screenplay, and if they don't sell it, they give up the career.
Right, right.
And he explained a completely different way to approach it. And so that, you know, that had a big impact on me.
So that was like a cumulative message that was, you interview a bunch of these guys and that kind of rises to the top. And that's, so that's got to mean something to a kid. It's like, well, not just one guy saying that, like, that's just the deal.
And, you know, as you read literature, so many of your favorite people wrote their best novels when they were much older.
Right.
And so you just start doing the math. Like, I need to evolve as a person. I need life experience. I need to fail at this work for a long time before I actually know how to do it.
Right, right.
And then maybe you make the great movie when you're 40, 50 years old. You're not, everyone doesn't kind of pull off Jaws when they're in their mid-20s.
Right.
and that was okay with me. Like, okay, I'm not, and I've always felt that way, like I'm about 10 years behind in a lot of ways, and that's fine. I don't have to be a wunderkind.
Oh, that's interesting that you say that, because I would not think that you're 10 years behind at all. I feel like, you know, at a fairly young age, you've created like a whole, you know, empire.
Well, I always looked at it like, you know, we did the Ben Stiller show, you know, in 1991, 92, and I could have asked to direct then. I was just terrified. I just thought, I don't even know how to do any of it. Will the eye lines match up? Will anything make sense? And so in an early situation where I could have said, Ben, let me direct one of them. I want to learn how to be a director.
Right.
I was terrified. I was like, what if it's bad? And what if I ruin the show?
Really?
So I didn't, you know, direct for, you know, another, you know, 5 years after that, just out of terror.
What was your first directing thing? Was it on Freaks and Geeks, or was it?
It was at the Larry Sanders Show. It was the last season. And what happened was that this psychic was visiting the show because we were writing an episode about a psychic who comes on the Larry Sanders Show. So I said, why don't we have a real psychic walk around the offices and I'll hang out with her. And then I'll get a sense of like how offices behave when a psychic talks to everybody.
Right.
And so the psychic was, you know, reading, you know, Jon Stewart was a writer there and an actor there at the time and all these different people and kind of blowing everyone's mind.
Really?
And then she said to me, there's going to be a flood at your house and you're going to direct soon. And within a month, there was a flood at my house. And then out of the blue one day, Gary just said to me, I want you to direct one of the episodes before the show's over. I never asked Gary to direct the show. The show was terrifying to me. I had been there for 6 years, but the idea that I was going to tell Rip Torn what to do, or Gary,
right,
did not seem like a wise move. So it was really incredibly kind and out of the blue for Gary to ask me to do it. And so I directed, I think, one of the last episodes.
I think that's fascinating that you were there 6 years and didn't ask to direct, even though that was in your mind of something you...
I was so bad at USC trying to make my little movies. They were so terrible. And I was in class with all these incredibly talented people that I lost all confidence in myself. I thought, I don't think visually I understand any of this.
Were you in class with people that went on to now be names?
Yes, yeah. Matt Reeves, who did, you know, Cloverfield and created Felicity. He was so brilliant in college.
Right.
I dropped out of college, and one of the things that made me okay with it was, I am nowhere near as talented as him. Why am I here? Like, maybe I should just be a stand-up comedian, and I'm not a filmmaker.
There's a parallel web show right now where Matt Reeves is going, Judd Apatow was in my class at USC.
No, he knows he was great in college. And his stuff was astounding. And I was just terrified. I just thought, I don't think I know how to do any of this. And then once I did it once and it came out well, I thought, oh, okay, you can do this. And when Paul Feig created Freaks and Geeks and we were making that together, I directed, you know, a few episodes of that. And the next show we did, Undeclared, I directed a few episodes of that.
Now, when you started on, like, Ben Stiller and Larry Sanders' show, Was that a natural transition from wanting to do the stand-up thing and being a comedian in front of the camera? Did that feel like a natural transition, like, oh, this is my place, or did it feel like giving up on the stand-up dream a little bit?
I was doing stand-up, and I knew I wasn't great at it. A lot of it was I was so young, and if you're 21, 22 years old, and you have no life experience, and you don't know anything except high school and not getting laid, and, right. and that just becomes your subject matter.
Right.
I mean, I was just bored of myself. At the same time, I was watching people like Jim Carrey and Adam Sandler and people like Bill Hicks and Sam Kinison, and there were so many brilliant people doing it. I knew I'm not in the same universe as these people. And I was such a fan of comedy, I thought, I don't want to be okay at this.
Uh-huh.
You know, I either want to do something incredible or get out of it. And then I kept getting offered jobs writing jokes for people, and that's how I paid my rent for a long time, is writing people's jokes. And then those people would get specials and cable specials. So, you know, I started writing cable specials for Tom Arnold and Roseanne, and wrote a pilot for Colin Quinn, and then I realized, oh, the universe is pulling me over here.
Right.
And then when the Ben Stiller Show got picked up, I that was right when my stand-up career started going a little better. I was on the HBO Young Comedian special. I wasn't very good on it, but I was on it. And I got too busy to do stand-up anymore, because we suddenly were producing this sketch show, and
right.
that was basically the end of my career.
Was there ever a moment when you had to say, like, I have to decide, or it just kind of
it
out
petered then. Out due to 14-hour work days at the
right.
Ben Stiller Show. And then when the Ben Stiller Show ended, I got offered a job writing for the Larry Sanders Show half the week, and the rest of the week I wrote on the show called The Critic, this animated show.
Oh, sure, I remember that.
Mike Reiss and Al Jean made. And so now I was busy doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you can't stay in at all the clubs, you're not getting enough stage time to remain a comedian.
Do you ever think now, life experience, everything, mm-hmm. would be fun to just flex that muscle or see how that would be and write 10 minutes?
Well, we did a lot of stand-up when we were working on Funny People. I went and did stand-up to write jokes to give to Adam, and I went around with Adam.
Oh, you did?
Sandler, when he was preparing. And it was fun to do, but it was weird because I would go to places like UCB, and the crowd is 18 years old. And I just thought, I'm so old in this space. You know, talking to college kids, and they're great crowds, but I thought, no one knows what I'm going through. Like, this isn't my audience.
Right.
And it felt strange. I felt terrible. Like,
really?
Oh my God, how did I get 25 years older than you? it was fun, but it didn't make me think, oh, I should do this all the time. I think it's good in between movies to get on stage and just get directly in contact with an audience and see what they laugh at and feel that relationship. That definitely feeds into the screenwriting. I probably should be doing it right now, but not as a full vocation.
Sure, sure. Is that like a test screening too? Like that? Is that the closest approximation to getting in front of a live audience, is doing a test screening of a film and seeing, like, sitting in the theater
yeah.
with your audience? Do you do that?
Yeah, we test like crazy. Because, I really feel like for most of these movies, if the audience doesn't like them, they're not working.
Right.
So, you know, I shoot a lot of jokes, a lot of options, and I like to show the movie. And you know, if a joke isn't working, I'll try some other joke that we shot. And, you know, where most people will test a movie once or twice, we'll test it like 6-7 times.
Oh, really?
And just keep flipping things in and out until we feel like we've found the movie.
You know, I remember when we did a test screening of the Wilco documentary, and there's a moment that gets a laugh that I never thought was funny.
Mm-hmm.
And that...
What was
that,
it?
Well, it was just when Jeff is going to sign some papers mm-hmm. in his lawyer's office, and he goes up the stairs, and the woman turns around and gives Jeff a second look.
Yeah.
You know, and for some reason, the audience thought it was funny. Like,
yeah.
And the reason it was funny is because they've got this conception of this independent artist scruffy guy and he's in this lawyer's office. And it's this out of place thing that I just saw it as getting the story from one place to another. And then it always got this laugh. And,
There's more information there than you realize.
Exactly. Have you ever had that moment where you don't even realize that, like, you're so inside the world, you don't see what an audience may find funny because it's fresh to them, even though it's not to you?
Yeah, you never know kind of what will make them respond or make noise. You don't know where the big laughs are. And that is the most fun part, is to show the movie for the first time. When we showed Superbad for the first time, I mean, the place just exploded. We just couldn't believe it. It was just pandemonium, and we were so happy. And that's about as much fun as we can have doing this.
Right,
is that moment where the crowd says, we like all of it. Because we kept thinking, is this too far? Are we going to scale some of this back? Is some of this too offensive? And then the crowd's like, no, thank you. And I remember when we showed The 40-Year-Old Virgin, the first time Steve, breaks into song and they start dancing, the people were so happy. I mean, it was just like as happy as I've ever seen a large group of people. And, in your head, you think, okay, they start dancing, maybe that'll be fun, we can get out of the movie, and it's kind of a way to show he's happy to not be a virgin anymore. And if it doesn't work, we'll just cut it off the end and end the movie on the kiss or the wedding. And then it's just euphoria. And that's like that kind of a surprise makes you so happy.
That's interesting, because I think that, when you see a movie that totally fails, especially a comedy, you figure everyone's sitting there in the edit bay going, oh yeah, this is funny, this is a comedy, this is working, and then it bombs.
Yes.
And I think that getting the tone right in a comedy is really hard. Thinking of funny people, I'm sure that was a big risk for you in your head of, how do I get this tone right? I'm trying to make a comedic movie about comedians, but to me, that film is, in a way, your most personal film. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you look at that film now, a few years, later, in terms of in the, the arc of the films you've made so far?
Well, I started writing that movie. My mom was sick. She had ovarian cancer, and she would be treated, and then she would wait to hear if she was getting better, and then sometimes she would think she was getting better, and all of her neuroses would return. So if she thought she was going to die, she would be very connected and very sweet and have that peace that you read about, like out of a Buddhist book. You could just see it in her face. And then the second they said, you're going to live, all of her neuroses return. What about this? What about that? Are we going to be okay with this? Or are we going to make enough money on that? And, and I just noticed that, and I wrote the movie about that. Like, can you receive the wisdom of your, the wisdom that's given to you when you're in a life-threatening situation? And I wanted to write about a comedian, and I thought, well, and I knew about like some executives I had read about who had kind of close calls with cancer, who didn't seem to learn anything from it. And that would always, I'd find that interesting, that person had cancer and it just like had zero effect on them. And so I thought, I can combine that, like a comedian who's just not picking up the lesson to, what life is really about. And then my mom passed away, pretty soon before we started shooting. So a movie like that is made a little bit in a fog of grief.
Yeah.
Because I haven't really processed how I feel about it, and I'm devastated, but I'm just powering through with work, and it's feeding what the work is about, but I've kind of gone crazy. And I'm, it's so, then like you watch it years later and you think, wow, something was going on here, and I'm glad that I expressed it.
Uh-huh.
I'm very happy with the movie and what it says, and I think Adam Sandler did a brilliant job, and Seth, and Leslie and Eric Bana and everybody, really came through with some amazing performances. But it is a sad movie. It is a movie that looks right into the face of something that people don't necessarily look for comedies to do. And it's not the 40-year-old Virgin, you know, which is, you know, ultimately kind of a very sweet romantic movie. You know, it's about hard stuff. And I thought, oh, what we could talk about all these issues of mortality and the decisions you make in your life through like a comedian, but not even like a Richard Pryor comedian, kind of like a comedian who has, you know, like a Rodney Dangerfield type of act.
Right, right.
Rodney Dangerfield type of career. That was, you know, some of the idea of it. It's not the most insightful person in the world who
right.
You know, he's not quoting Nietzsche.
Right, he's something he made clicked and he built a career off of it.
Yeah, he's a very like needy, hurt, wounded guy that lives off of the idea of enormous success and enormous amount of love, and he's still kind of miserable, and then he suddenly realizes, oh, that doesn't fill you up at all, and now it might end, and all I got was this kind of shallow reaction that I begged for my whole life, and no one's around, I don't have any significant relationships.
Right.
So where am I gonna get one? Maybe my ex-girlfriend, maybe I can get that one going again. Maybe with this kid who's hanging out with me, you know, is he my friend? And so it's ultimately, there's a sadness to it, but what I like about it is, you know, when it ends, he realizes, you know, sometimes life is as simple as just writing a joke for the kid. You know,
right.
But that's all life is really, is, you know, a giving gesture to somebody else. You know, it's not really about being the star of that movie. It's like, you know, the contribution you make to other people. And that small gesture is important.
He grows up a little bit in that film. And I, you know, I was listening to some interview with John Hamm.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked him to describe Don Draper. And he said, well, it's the opposite of the Apatowian man-child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I started thinking about that. And I started thinking about the four films in particular that you've directed that have this through line of... I mean, they really are coming-of-age films at different stages. And you know, 40-year-old Virgin, he has to face kind of his cowardice as well as, you know, like each one has to, like, face this thing in order to move on to the next phase of being a man.
Yeah.
You know? And that's what's interesting about your films is that I laugh like crazy when I'm in them, but I don't take away from them... Like, you watch a film like The Hangover, you just take away a comedy.
Yeah.
But you watch a film like yours and you enjoy it like a comedy in the theater, but you take away more of a look at what it is to be a man. You know, and I think that, I don't want to call them subversive, but there's a larger theme or a story being told by you there that seems to keep repeating itself at different stages of life. Is that, I mean, is it really you in each one of those character modes in some ways, or is it, or is that a theme you're trying to always look at and explore?
I don't know. Someone said to me, you know, you always wind up making the same movie every time, even when you don't think you are. Like, if you really look at, like, all of Woody Allen's movies, like, they're all basically the same movie in some respect. And so, I, you know, I'm definitely interested in how hard it is to learn lessons and how hard it is to have wisdom. And I like people who are, like, trying to do the right thing and the obstacles to that. You know, in a lot of ways, like, I think, you know, that is why I like Mad Men, because, you know, I actually think that he is a version of that kind of man-child. He's out trying to get laid, and he's drinking, and kind of, you know, he's avoiding responsibilities. He's trying to be happy, doesn't feel fulfilled. You know, it's a different kind of variation of a certain kind of existential funk. Like, life doesn't make sense. That's kind of the George Simmons thing. And Funny People is, you know, he's on stage and he talks about how his parents don't believe in God. And he has this rant where he says, Dad, is there a God? No. You just go in the ground, go to sleep. You know,
and
to me, that's kind of what Mad Men is about.
Yeah,
in a way, is you just go, this life is so weird. What do I make of it? And all you could be selfish, or spin out in misery, or you could say, okay, I guess my life is about trying to do something positive for other people that I can be fulfilled by, or I can just hide in the stockroom of the store and not face it. But those questions of, you know, how to make this work and how to connect with other people, because we're all crazy, and when we try to get along, it never works. It doesn't work out smoothly. It's always a train wreck in some way. And so you could either hang in there and just keep trying. And that's a little bit of what This Is 40 is about. Mm-hmm. It's like two people with serious problems. They're going to go at it hard. It doesn't mean they don't love each other, and it doesn't mean they can't ultimately make it work and be a really positive thing. But it's hard. You know, my crazy is different than someone else's crazy, and you get us in a room together, anything can happen.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's what I'm interested in, bad communication, you know, the struggle to make things not be madness.
Well, it's like a connection. I mean, as you're talking, I'm imagining my wife and I looking at this interview together later. Mm. And what it is what you just said is a jumping off point for a conversation that can hopefully bring two kinds of crazy a little closer together,
yes.
Right? And I think it's kind of a generational thing, because Mad Men was the generation where it was like, go to sleep.
Yeah.
But I think in your films, there is there's this acceptance of, hey, men can talk about their feelings, and when they do, good things always happen.
Yeah. Or they just get more confused. That's why I like in This Is 40 that you could tell they've been to therapy and they've been told a lot of rules about how to be nice to each other and how to use I messages and all of that. But it ultimately doesn't work fully because you're just so enraged or you're bottling up so many resentments that it's just going to blow. Every once in a while it just has to blow.
Sure.
And then you kind of see what the other person was really thinking. And then can you have some compassion and empathy for their situation? Can they have it for you? But you can't keep it kind of, you know, mild. It just, we all lose our minds every once in a while. There's too much going on. There's too much pressure. We're trying to be great parents. You know, we're trying to be great spouses. We're trying not to screw up work. We're dealing with these extended families. We're dealing with the, you know, everything insane happening politically and in the media, and every once in a while we just lose our shit.
Yeah.
It just crumbles. And is that person there for you? Do they understand that? Like, you know, today Judd is worthless and a dick, and but tomorrow hopefully he'll pull it back together. And we're all going through that in some way with each other.
Well, I think it's the patience thing you talk about in a career too, and you know, maybe people think in marriage that same thing doesn't apply, but it's the same thing. It's like you can hear that idea in therapy about I messages. Mm-hmm. It may take 10 years for it to sink in that, you know, and having, I think that a lot of people assume when they get married that kind of is the end of the story, and it's really just the beginning of the story.
Well, it's ultimately some sort of self-exploration. I'm fascinated with pop psychology. I've read every book ever. I've seen them all. I listened to them all. You know, I couldn't find it all more fascinating. But ultimately, I think what I believe is that, you know, you get married and the person puts up a mirror to you and you're forced to face yourself.
Right.
And you either can be happy that they did that and you feel like, that's the point of marriage, is for me to evolve and for my partner to force me to face some things I don't want to face, or you're just really mad at them.
You just resent them
How
forever.
How dare you point that out about
me? Exactly.
You know? Don't you dare say I'm a workaholic. What's wrong with you? Or you can say, oh, maybe I could cut my hours down a little bit. What am I chasing? What am I trying to accomplish? What am I hiding from by working or whatever the issue is? And you have to like the fact that you're being confronted.
Exactly. And you have to like the person confronting you.
Well, that helps. Yes, exactly.
Okay. I want to ask you about that transition to being a director.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was something that went off in your head, light bulb wise, the first time you did it, like something that worked for you, where you said, oh, I get it. I know how to get what I want out of actors, or did it just turn out that it wasn't that different than anything else, and you just had to actually do it?
I think it's like taking the training wheels off. I could sit with Gary Shandling while we were rehearsing scenes for the Larry Sanders Show, and he would say, "Do you think this scene is working?" And I would have, you know, solid opinions about ways to fix things, and he would adjust things sometimes based on those notes, and then you would see, like, oh, this scene's a little better with that line, or getting out of the scene earlier. But the idea of doing it without Gary standing next to me you know, that's what freaks you out. You know, who's going to make sure I know what I'm doing? And so it is, it's like this, you know, losing the security blanket. It's great to be the right-hand man to other people. I've worked on a lot of movies where I'm the last-minute punch-up guy, or I'm the producer supporting a great director, and I'm kind of giving advice. But, you know, when you're the person making all the final calls, you know, you're kind of like jumping off a cliff and hoping you know what you're doing and that it's all going to make sense at the end. There's a real, you know, leap of faith. I go, okay, well, we're just going to give this all we have every day and be as creative as we can be, get as many options as we can. And at some point, I'm just sitting in an edit bay and I'm trying to figure out if I, you know, did I get it?
Right.
You know, is there, you know, in editing, you're kind of rewriting the movie, especially the way we do it because we shoot so much. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a documentary. We have so much footage that there's 25 versions of the movie in there. And then you sit for 6 months, and at some point you think, I either did it, or I guess maybe I didn't do it. You know, you don't know.
Was there, like in the case of the, you know, learning how to be a comedian and calling a bunch of comedians, did you put yourself in any kind of mentor position talking to a few directors? Or at that point, were you like, I can do this?
Well, the person that taught me the most about directing was Jake Kasdan. So Jake directed the pilot of Freaks and Geeks and was a producer on Freaks and Geeks. So when I had to direct a few episodes, he was the person that would sit with me with a piece of paper and say, I think if you're shooting a rock band, you probably need these angles. And watching Jake on a daily basis was probably the biggest education that I got. I mean, I watched Ben Stiller direct the Ben Stiller Show and all the people that directed the Larry Sanders Show. You know, all of that was very helpful. But when I had to do it, Jake was the guy.
He was
standing next to me when I was terrified and telling me it was going okay.
And what was your biggest fear? Was it where to put the camera and knowing how to get the coverage? Or was it, I'm gonna impart the wrong whatever it is to an actor and alienate them?
Like, I really just had a completely irrational fear that I would get into an edit bay and none of the footage would fit together.
Oh, really?
And like, you'd be looking that way and the other guy would be looking that way. And like, I just didn't really understand that that's the easiest part. But I had, you know, a phobia about
right,
it.
Right.
And so I you know, avoided it because I really thought it would be disastrous where people thought I was crazy.
Really?
Not just bad, but like, it literally doesn't even, nothing fits.
It's that same fear you're going to walk into a room and have people say, you don't, like, what are you doing? This.
Yeah, every once in a while you just, you know, I just didn't have that faith in myself because I hadn't done it and I just needed to do it. And you know, thank God Gary Shelley made me do it.
Did it take a long time for you to feel like you belonged in a room no matter who was in the room?
I don't feel that. I'm not comfortable generally anyway. Like almost any interaction I can just go home and just go, God, what did you say?
Oh really?
What are you
to
doing?
This day?
Oh yeah. I'm doing it now as we talk. Like, what are you talking about? Are you? Should you be funnier now? Like, are you making any sense? Are you using like the same 8 words over and over again? Like, after any interaction, I can just beat up on myself and go, "You're so stupid. And who cares? And just shut up."
God,
and that voice is big in my head. It's one of the reasons why I stopped doing stand up. And then when you make movies, it's crazy because like then you make something, you have to do hundreds of interviews.
Right,
you have to just
right.
put, you know, and if you're doing personal work, you're really just exposing your balls and your heart, and then you're just like taking the reaction. So, you know, for someone that feels that way anyway,
yeah,
it's just it's a real emotional ride to say, this is what I feel about everything. This is what I feel about family and existence and mortality and, you know, sexuality and everything. And then just wait for the reaction. but I don't know, that's what kind of comedians do. They want the approval so bad that they're willing, you know, most people would never stand up in front of 300 people and tell jokes.
Sure.
But comedians are so insecure that they have to, because they have to be told that they're okay.
And you know? It's like a constant test, right? Like. Yeah. Last week, you were told you're okay, but that won't hold you.
Nothing holds you. You just, you know, I did a Jimmy Fallon, you know, a couple of months ago, and like it went great. But like the feeling is gone almost as I'm walking off the stage there. And then it just turns into like, Were you good? Were you just obnoxious? What's that attitude you have on there? You know, and then that voice goes. And then you, part of you is like, should you do another one? Or should you just not do one for a really long time? And I had a therapist once, he called that voice, he's like, you should name it. It's like the beast. It's like your critical
it's
inner
your
voice.
Dad's name or your mom's
no,
name.
No, they were actually supportive. You know, you do try to like figure out like, who is that?
Yeah.
Who put that in my head? But it also drives you to make more work. That's the strange part.
You don't want that voice to go away entirely because you might go make something really mediocre and say, it's fine.
Yeah, no, it makes you terrified. It's the thing that makes me shoot 12 jokes for a moment when I need one.
Right.
Because I'm so afraid I'm going to screw it up that I just cover my ass for the edit bay.
Right, right.
You know, it makes me work hard. There's no part of me that feels comfortable because some of our projects have gone well. Like, I don't have any level of ease. Like, you know what you're doing, you've succeeded before, it can happen again. It's all like day one.
Really?
You know, in my head.
That's amazing.
Stakes-wise.
To this point, it's still, yeah. Still.
If I'm going to write a movie now, like I'm about to start writing a movie, and I'm just like, oh, Jesus, I got to go start.
Right.
What if it makes no sense? What if it doesn't work? Am I going to shoot it? What if none of it makes, what if it doesn't, what if I have nothing to say? What if I have the wrong actors? And then you, at some point you just go, fuck it. You just do it. You just jump in. You go, this is what I do. And then you just
right.
have to make something.
And is any of that connected to security anymore for you? What if I have no career? You know,
None of it was ever really about, I mean, I never did anything for financial security because I always felt like I could feed myself. There was just a feeling I had, like, I was a good dishwasher. I was a good, you know, busboy. Like, I just thought, you know, I'm a hardworking guy. Like, you put me in any situation, I'm happy to be the hardest working guy there. So I'll right. always eat. And then when you make some money, most of it doesn't really matter because all I buy in life is, like, DVDs and CDs. I don't really do anything that costs any money. And so the security is just, I want to be able to make something else. I want the last one to be good enough so they'll allow me to do the next one. And that's kind of all I really care about. You know, like, okay. So that was close. We can go again, right? Okay. That's the only security I want. And then I'll kind of risk again. I'm not making adjustments in my work to be successful or to get to work again. You know, my choices are very personal and that overwhelms the need for my career to go well. Like whatever I want to write about, like I kind of can't help but do that at that moment. The world really wasn't crying out for a dying comedian movie.
Right.
I just, I had to say that. And that's been good for me is because that's I am driven by something else, which is I have to work something out personally, and I do it through what I write about and direct about. And I can't, that always is the main driver, is you'd have to write about this or you're gonna go crazy.
Well, that's how the best art gets made. Yes. I mean, 100%, that's the unifying factor of all art is when it's made from that place, whether it's good or bad, it's almost critic proof in a way, because if it works for you, then that's the important thing in the long run.
Well, yeah, some people will say, well, why didn't you do it this way? Or why wasn't that part funnier? Why didn't you make it shorter? Why didn't you? And I just think, this is what it was.
It had to be.
This is what that story was.
Right.
And so at some level, it's not even good, bad, do you like it, do you not like it? It's just like, no, that's what he would say then. I can't change that. That's how he would react.
The authenticity of it. It has to be.
So someone might say, well, why didn't you cut 20 minutes out of it? No, because I have to say these things. And so if you need to sit for 20 more minutes, like I can't get through the thought any other way. And so that's the experience of this. It's not kind of built to service you completely. You know, primarily it has to service the idea. right. and the characters, you know, so if they need to say it, we're going to sit for a couple more minutes to get that across, which also has been, you know, I think kind of helpful overall for the work, because I'm not a, you know, a slave to the marketplace. I really want the audience to love the movie and to connect right. emotionally and to laugh, but I won't kind of sell my soul to accomplish that. So I'm really trying for these things to be successful, but successful as an experience, not, you know, because sometimes movies don't do great, but then for some reason people love them forever in different formats, on
right.
Netflix, on cable, and a movie that bombed like Harold and Maude is one of the great movies of all
exactly.
time.
Exactly.
And so those people, they can't judge it based on that 2 month period where it didn't make enough money.
Right, like Hal Ashby's a perfect example of someone who's universally seen as this amazing, amazing filmmaker, but yet probably lost money for anyone he ever worked with.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
No, I think that's, and those are our favorite movies, you know, for some reason they just hang around, they have some resonance. King of Comedy. Mm-hmm. People talk about King of Comedy now as this classic movie, but it didn't do well when it came out, and it took like a long time for people to say, I think King of Comedy is kind of awesome. And it gets better by the year, and hopefully, you know, with some of our movies, you know, we're having that experience. You know, sometimes the movies that are the most successful are not the best ones. They just satisfied people right. in the moment, but they're a little more disposable.
Well, King of Comedy and Harold and Maude are both films that were really spot on at capturing their generation. Mm-hmm. Like when you think of how Harold has to fill out forms
yes.
at the hospital,
yeah.
it's mm-hmm. such a statement on the state of healthcare in the 70s in this country. And yet, that film was, when it was made, it was current.
Yeah.
So maybe it couldn't be seen for what mm-hmm. we can see it now, which
sure.
is a larger statement on mm-hmm. what our times were. And King of Comedy, I think, same thing. Like, it's hard to see New York in that light.
Yes.
when you're living there.
Yes.
In that time.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I guess that's the ultimate test of movies: is do they last over time?
Yeah.
Do they?
Well, I made a movie in the 90s. I was one of the producers of The Cable Guy. And I met with this great filmmaker, and he said, you know, you won't know for 10 years if that movie is good or not. Like, because I was like, I don't know. We love it. Didn't do that well, but we're so proud of it. And the chances that everybody took. And he was like, don't even think about it for 10 years.
That's interesting.
And then you see, you know, what builds up a little cult following and what, you know, what people still want to see. You know, because other movies just... they disappear.
Right, you know. Right. Now, do you see a difference? I mean, obviously, if you write and direct a film, that's a different deal. But in terms of your commitment to the film, do you have a different level of commitment to something you produce versus something you direct? And how do you, like, how is your role different in producing versus directing?
You know, every movie is different. Some movies I'm deeply involved creatively. Other movies I'm just trying to get someone the money and the protection
okay.
to make their film without interference, and it's really every situation is very unique. You know, my goal is to have to do nothing. If I could do nothing, I would be thrilled. I don't want to do anything, but if I think the third act doesn't work, I'll sit with the writers and try to crack
okay.
a better third act. If they don't have enough money, I might, you know, fight with the studio to get them more money and more time. I'm literally just looking for leaks in the boat. And you know, sometimes movies are really easy and sometimes they're, you know, a fight the whole way through. And I'm trying to preserve the creative vision of the director and the writer of those movies while being really tough on them and questioning everything and challenging everything. But I do want them to have their sense of authorship about what they're doing.
Right.
And so it's
right.
a fine line, because sometimes you're in that weird, you know, sometimes you're the man and you're the person saying, like, I know you think it's working, but it's not working. But you have to know when to step back and say,
right.
but I could be wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, when can you just let them do it anyway and find out for themselves? Or, you know, I had a movie once in the that I wrote, and the studio at the last minute threw out the third act and hired someone else to write it, and then they called me back in to write the reshoots because they didn't like the third act, they hired someone else to write, and I thought, I should have went to war to stop them from throwing out the third act to begin with, but I didn't really think it was my place to get that aggressive with them. But that's, you know, that's what you're debating in your mind all the time, because you kind of don't know if things are going to work. So how much do you fight for things when, you know, who knows if any scene's going to work or any story's going to work? So the key is, you know, to have people you're collaborating with, writers, directors, and actors that, you know, that are in sync. You know, if we all like each other and we have common goals and have a way of working that's respectful of each other, it tends to be really fun. But all it takes is one person that works differently or is out of sync for the whole machine to clog up.
Well, it seems like you've created this kind of fraternal empire in some ways of, and you know, I look back, it kind of seems like it had its origins in some way in Freaks and Geeks. Mm-hmm. And it didn't crystallize for me until that Vanity Fair issue that you guest edited. Mm-hmm. And you look at the class picture of Freaks and Geeks. Yeah. Was there a sense, even in that one season, that these actors were very special and destined for big things?
You know, it felt like the whole project was special. You know, from the moment I got the script from Paul Feig, and I looked at the cover, and he didn't even tell me what it was going to be about. He just said, I wrote a pilot, you want to read it? And I opened it up and it said Freaks and Geeks, and I was gone. I was like, I just knew it right there, like, this is going to be the best thing ever. Like, I don't know, just even the name, like, it's everything I thought about. I felt like a geek, I hung out with freaks, I understood what Paul was attempting to do. And then we first hired Jake Kasdan on to direct the pilot, and we all, you know, worked really hard on getting that pilot script exactly right. And we did a process with the actors where we said, you know, we're just going to read a ton of kids and then have Paul rewrite the pilot based on finding great kids. We're not going to make,
oh, really?
We're not going to say we need this, like there was a kid in the pilot Paul wrote that looked like Peter Frampton and had a specific personality. And we said, you know, let's just find the cast, and then you rewrite based on those personalities.
So what did you have them do in the room? Did you have them play, did you bring a couple kids in the room at one time, or?
We had Paul write generic scenes. So there was a freak scene where a kid was bragging about how his drum kit had 32 pieces and talking about his dream of being a drummer. And there was another scene where the kid was talking about how his dream is to grow pot underground. And then if the cops ever come, you could blow the entrance and they would just see a cornfield and then you wouldn't get caught. And then we just had tons of kids read it. Thousands of kids would read these scenes. And then we had different scenes for the geeks. And slowly we realized, oh, this James Franco kid, he shouldn't even do this show, he's so good. He doesn't even realize, like, it's a mistake even to take a TV show. It was so obvious that this was a movie star. And then we met Jason Segel, who was just graduating high school, and Seth Rogen, we saw in Vancouver, was so demented and funny. We read a ton of people for the part of Lindsay, and Linda Cardellini was brilliant, and it was pretty clear that you could build the whole show around her. Mm-hmm. And we had a similar process with the geeks where we just read thousands of geeky kids. And then at some point we thought, okay, these three will work together. And now Paul can go off and adapt everything to the fact that, okay, it's the Martin Starrs, you know, the tall, mm-hmm. you know, tall, strange kind of yep. geek who's a little
with the glasses.
Also aggressive, yeah. you know, and Sam Levine, who's, he did impressions at the audition of William Shatner, and he was so funny
really?
And comedy fan geeky. And then John Daly, who was so sweet and kind of the guy that we felt like, oh, we were like John.
That's
when
what
we
I
were
figured.
In high school. But I also felt like Martin because my parents got divorced, so we wrote a lot of that material through Bill's character when his mom dates the gym teacher. So in a way, by the end of it, we all felt like we were everybody.
But that's why the casting is so special, because it was more of a search for seven or eight amazing people and adapting it to them. So we looked for special people.
And there was no sense of, we have to anchor this with a known person. You didn't want that at all.
Well, we got lucky because the head of the network had stepped down, and so when we were casting, there was no head of the network, and so we just slipped by
in
this odd moment of transition.
And were there sometimes when a kid would walk in and the look was so perfect, you would just say to yourself, I really hope this person has something? Like, yeah. Do you go visually off people like that?
Oh, that's a part of it. You know, Busy Phillips came in, and she read for Lindsay, but then Paul had been working on this character of like the really tough freak girl, and she instantly seemed perfect and hilarious. So that happens too. Yeah, for all of them, there is a visual dynamic, because in a way, like it's like putting a band together.
Right, right.
And so it's great that, you know, Seth looks this way, next to Jason, next to Franco, like it looks like a crew of guys.
And is there anything that you now do based on maybe those early experiences that like is kind of a casting thing, like one of your casting tools?
Well, we did the same thing with Girls. When Lena Dunham was looking for the cast of Girls, I just said, you know, just look for like great women and then rewrite the pilot. And so it wasn't written exactly like it turned out in the pilot. You know, she left some space to define it based on finding these people.
Right.
And she had some sense of it, but then those people really make it come alive. And then you understand, oh, now that we have the cast, I get it. Those two people would get along, but those two people kind of wouldn't. And you write to that.
Right. Is there a particular audition that stands out just for its either weirdness or blew everyone away in the room? Like, is there something that to this day you still something that sticks in your mind for being like a coalescing moment? Or
When Jonah Hill came in for the 40-year-old virgin, he read for one line, and we just liked him. We just thought, oh, I like that guy. Like, you know, he was just a young, I don't know if he was taking Groundlings classes or something, but
right.
We didn't know him. I think Seth bumped into him at the movies the night before, and Jonah said, hey, I'm coming in to read tomorrow. But we just took to him, and then the day we shot with him, we said, you know, we have a lot of time today. Let's like force him to improvise with Catherine Keener, and it'll scare him. We thought it'd be funny to like take some kid and make him improvise for an hour with the greatest actress ever. and then he was so funny. And we thought, well, we can't use all this in the movie. It has nothing to do with our story. And at the very last preview, I said, I'm going to put in like 90 seconds of him arguing with Keener just for no reason, just to see how much people like Jonah.
Right.
And it all got huge laughs. So we left it in
the
movie. And then I started writing Knocked Up, and I thought, oh, well, now you have to give Jonah kind of a big part, because he clearly fits into our world so well. And that happens every once in a while. You meet somebody, and we met Aubrey Plaza for Funny People, and she just seemed hilarious and perfect. And I think it was her first or second meeting she ever had.
I think that's fascinating. You've created, you don't seem like you ever want to go after the star that's already established. Like, is it much more exciting for you to find someone that...
Well, it's more about trying to figure out what is funny about somebody. You know, once someone's established, this is what I do.
Right.
To me, some of the fun is gone. It's great. I mean, people are brilliant, and you know, working with someone like John Lithgow on This Is 40 was one of the great experiences I've ever had. But it's different than meeting somebody who has not cracked what their screen persona is or what their appeal is, and working with them to make them, you know, a leading person.
Right.
You know, Steve Carell had never been the lead in a movie, so it was fun to sit with Steve and go, what do you like as the lead guy? How does that work? And you know, those conversations are so exciting because the stakes are so high. And guys like him and Melissa McCarthy, they're so ready. They're so funny.
Right.
But there's work to be done. Like, you know, how loud are you? How quiet are you? How interior are you?
So you're really almost trying to help them map that out and see that for themselves in a way when you're...
Yeah.
It must be a great feeling to look at Steve Carell after The Office and after all these films and go, we found that.
Well, the thing is, we're not really like finding anything because these are the most talented people, but I always feel like you could be the most talented person, but a script or a project never lines up with you and then it never happens. You know, Melissa McCarthy could have been a huge star 5 years ago, but did she get the right script at the right time? And was she with a director that understood what she does? And to me, the heartbreak is there are tons of people that the timing and the luck and the right collaboration never happens.
Yeah.
There's a magic to just, bumping into the right person at the right time and something coming together, because all these things could easily not happen.
Sure.
So I feel lucky that I get to be a part of their thing. I don't really look at it like, oh, we're giving people a break. It's more like, it's really fun to help people reach their potential,
right,
and to give them these opportunities. And that to me is what I'm searching for. So with Kristen Wiig, she was in Knocked Up, she was in Walk Hard, and we just had a sense like, she's kind of the funniest woman, right? She's unbelievably funny and ready for this. And so she wrote with Annie Mumolo, Bridesmaids, and we just grinded it for years and years. Like, who are you as the star? Who are you as just Kristen and not a sketch character? And
right,
that's really challenging and super fun. And then when it works, there's nothing more exciting, and also more exciting for an audience, because an audience loves a new comedy star. I mean, when I saw Todd Phillips' movie The Hangover and saw Zach Galifianakis on screen, you're just in heaven seeing a fully formed comic persona kicking ass.
Right.
Like, there's nothing better than that, really. So, in addition to the other things we do, that's part of what excites me about the business.
No, it almost makes you want to just twice a year get a room and cast for something that doesn't even exist.
And comedy's so popular now, and with Second City and UCB and Comedy Central and the comedy clubs, there's I think there's a lot more people who were raised on comedy. No one was raised on it when I was a kid. There was a few hundred comics.
Right.
But now there's all these people making YouTube videos and Funny or Die videos, and they know what they're doing. There's just a lot of people who are ready for these opportunities. So it's kind of the golden era of comedy at this moment.
Does some of that fraternal feeling for you and getting involved with them and staying involved with this group of people that you've kind of engendered, does that kind of go back to that original kindness that you also felt with the comedian thing when you, when you were...
Sure. I mean, the fact that comedians were nice to me when I was a kid and helped me learn about how to do it, it just sets... just sets you in the in motion to want to do that for somebody else.
Right.
And I mean, I wasn't very conscious of that till it was already happening. I mean, obviously I have interest in finding new people, but then when I meet people, I want them to do well, and I want them to do well even after we work together. I have kind of a child of divorce codependency. So I want everyone to continue to succeed, whether it's with me or without me. I feel like this is all kind of one big family of comedy people, and everybody's nice, and so we all give each other notes, and sometimes I'm asking for advice, sometimes people are asking me for advice, and that's how I like to work, and I think it's benefited everybody in comedy. If I have a movie, when I first screen it for friends before I show a real audience, I'll invite every comedy writer and comedy director on earth and say, please feel free to destroy me, but what do you think? How's this going? And people show up, and then when they have movies, we all show up, for them when they want us to. And that's been, I think, one of the reasons why I think the success rate of comedies has gone up, is it's a little more communal.
Right, right. No, I would see that that's part of your success, is that you are more open to the idea of asking your peers for criticism and asking for help on that. Yeah. I mean, I wonder also if looking at some of the other careers that you've helped kind of start, is there someone that stands out to you that whose career is really not the biggest surprise, but who you've really gone, wow, that person went a long way from a very humble beginning?
Well, you know, Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg just made this incredible movie, This Is the End.
Uh-huh.
And it, you know, it is riotously funny, and it's, you know, at its heart, it's very sweet, and it's about friendship. But they just take it to a whole nother level, and they did an amazing job as directors of just both the actors and what it looks like. And so, you know, to meet guys who started working on Superbad when they were 13 years old, and now they're full-fledged comedy directors who've made a, you know, a classic, you know, all by themselves. You know, I'm very, you know, happy and, you know, proud of those guys, because, you know, it takes, right, you know, an enormous amount of work and balls to say, I want to do this and to take that risk. And so, you know, to pull it off is just a gigantic accomplishment.
Do they almost feel like family to you at this point, too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I've known some of these people since they were in high school.
Yeah.
So Seth always says, like, I'm more like the creepy uncle, you know. But it does feel that way to me, because it's interesting. It's like, my daughter's 15. I've known Seth since he was 16 years old. So I used to worry about,
right,
like, Seth, like, okay, his family moved from Canada to the United States so he could be on Freaks and Geeks, and then they just stayed after our show was canceled really quickly.
Did you feel like a responsibility or a weight that when the show got canceled towards his family?
Well, I felt it towards everybody's family. I just thought, oh man, Jason Segel didn't go to college, and you know, and I felt that way about a lot of them. So it wasn't, I didn't really take all of that on, but when opportunities would present themselves where we could all work together and have fun and continue, you know, our creative process, I was interested in doing it, you know, wherever it made sense.
Right.
Because I thought our work was unfinished, that Freaks and Geeks was really good, it ended prematurely, and somehow we need to fulfill the potential of the show. Some of that was doing Undeclared with a lot of the same people, and then making movies like Forgetting Sarah Marshall and Knocked Up, and you know, and slowly having different opportunities to work with different cast members and writers and directors from the show. And in a lot of ways, it was me refusing to acknowledge that the show ended, because I just kept it going,
right,
in some form with everyone. You know, a lot of these movies in my head, they're all episodes of Freaks and Geeks.
Really?
You could look at all of it as just some weird extension of that series.
Right, like those kids started there and now they're...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, of course, everyone starts branching out. Everyone's getting older. People aren't kids anymore. And slowly, it's not that anymore. But for a while, you know, to me, it was, you know, it's a beautiful thing.
And was your office kind of like that fraternal? Mm-hmm. Like, were you the hub for a lot of that activity when the kids were younger, in terms of advice and things like that?
For the ones who wanted it. You know, I encouraged all of them. You know, in order to be an actor or an actress, you should probably try to write, because there's not that many good scripts and there's not that many great jobs out there. So you need to make your own opportunities. And, you know, John Daly, you know, wrote Burt Wonderstone and was one of the people who made Horrible Bosses. You know, Busy Phillips has the story credit on Blades of Glory. And, you know, there's so many of them from the show have kind of made their own futures by writing.
Right.
And so that was the main piece of advice I gave everybody.
Was Freaks and Geeks, when it got canceled, did you consider it that it was ahead of its time, or was it a failure, or was it just a couple knuckleheaded TV executives that didn't allow it to go on? What was your impression walking away from that process of being prematurely cut off on that?
It just felt like, you know, you need champions to survive. If you're on the bubble, you need someone to say, you know, I don't care that the ratings aren't good. This is important, and we like it, and so we're going to let you continue to make these, and hopefully you'll find your audience. So there are shows that people love, like, whether it's Community,
sure,
or even Seinfeld, after the first five episodes, no one was really watching it, but there were people there who believed in it. And for us, we just didn't have those people at the network. And I, you know, some people have said it felt a little bit like an independent movie, and there was no place for that on network TV. You know, I don't think it would work now on network TV. It would have worked as a great HBO show or something.
Right. But were you mature enough in your thinking to say we didn't have those champions, or at the time, did it feel like, oh, I, you know.
At the time, I was just crying. just crying and screaming and taking Vicodin for my back, which was herniated. I wasn't mature enough to separate the business from my personal feelings about the project and my projection of all my emotional problems onto my relationships with the executives. It was a catastrophe in my head, because I felt like this is an exaggeration and I'm taking it too far, but like, you know, we're making Sgt. Pepper here and they're not letting us finish. You know, we're on song 3 and someone's unplugging. And so I knew how good all the actors and writers and directors were, and I had a sense, oh, something, you know, really special's happening, and they don't get it, and they're literally going to shut it down. And it broke my heart in a way that, like, I probably never recovered from. But it's also motivated a lot of what I've done since, because a lot of what I've done since is done out of almost some bizarre sense of revenge. I'll show you that all these people are talented and that we were doing something special and everyone here deserves to be heard. Now it's almost like I'm in the post-revenge phase. I have to find other motivations to work.
Forgiveness. Isn't it revenge? And then
exactly. Revenge against people who don't care.
Right.
They don't care.
You put your family in This Is 40 too, at an extreme level.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have young kids, and part of my decisions about what the projects I do are based upon wanting to be there. Mm-hmm. I don't know a lot of great directors mm-hmm. who can be great dads. And mm-hmm. am I wrong in thinking that a big part of you doing that is just to not have to be away from your family?
I think it's a combination of, you know, my interest in personal filmmaking, you know, my belief that my family is filled with really fascinating, awesome, interesting people, and the fact that I like, you know, shooting in town, and
right.
and I like combining our goal as a family. You know, sometimes it's weird to like leave your family to go make something, and they're kind of not a part of it. But the idea that, you know, just as a piece of storytelling, that I could say to Leslie and Maude and Iris, well, this is why we're making this movie, and here's the things that we can say about life and family and ways that we can be funny, was so incredible and fun. And it's also really dangerous and stupid in a lot of ways, because if it's terrible, it's kind of a worldwide humiliation and you've kind of pulled your family into it. But I thought, you know, years ago, and I always quote this, but someone said, you know, the best gift you can give other people is your story. And that's something to be proud of, that even though, you know, the movie's fabricated in a sense, it is how we feel about different issues, about family life and marriage and all the pressures we feel as people at this time. And that it's good to share that with people. And the best reaction I've gotten from the movie has been, you know, just messages from people who say, you know, you made me and my husband feel less crazy. Or, we had a great talk, after that. Or, you know, some people who can deeply get what I'm talking about, which is, you know, we're all on this journey together and it gets really complicated. And even when you love people, you have moments where, you know, the roof caves in and then you kind of pull yourself together and learn something from it and move forward. Obviously, you know, my family is much different, you know, than what's portrayed in the movie.
Sure.
You know, it's a fabricated exaggeration of us in the worst possible circumstance, because that's what I find funny. The 98% of the time where we're all getting along great and having fun is just not a funny movie.
That's not a movie.
It's just a boring thing. You know, but the day of the big fight is, to me, really interesting and emotional and hopefully funny. And I love working with Leslie, because when we start a project, you know, it starts years of collaboration where I might have an idea for a story, and then she says, well, then you need this scene, and then you should have a scene, you know, where you show me in a club and how I react if somebody hits on me and what that feels like and how I respond to people liking me and how I feel at home, and we have this kind of great run of writing sessions together.
So it's like you get, it's date night. You're together more.
Yeah.
But also you get a women's perspective on your filmmaking.
Well, I can't write about most of that accurately. And so, it is a true, very intense, deep collaboration. An enormous amount of those scenes are things that Leslie says, you should do, you got to do this scene then. And then we talk about it. And so there literally are years where there's script pages and we talk and she'll say, that doesn't seem right. Or she'll come up with a funny joke and call bullshit on things. And then her acting is just ridiculous because she's the only person I know who can be completely real and dramatic and find a way to be really funny simultaneously.
Yeah,
it's just a gift that she has that is really fun to be able to work with. Because that's what I like when it's like you're playing a deadly serious and it can still be high comedy. And she goes there emotionally in a way that most people aren't able to. I mean, she's committed. And then the kids see her and then they're fully committed. And you just get a different type of performance. It doesn't feel like most comedies. It's almost like there is a documentary feel to it.
Well, yeah, I wondered, you know, being a dad, if having your girls in that working situation, if there's any of that where at one point you feel like, well, maybe I'm taking them along too quick, or are there any negative aspects from a father position, or is it just great to have them around?
I'm sure there's all sorts of issues that I didn't understand that
you'll find out
later. But you know, they're really funny. They like being on sets. They like performing. It's not like we're trying to launch their careers, because we're not. We were just trying to make this thing. And then if at some point they decide they want to do it, that'll be up to them when it's the right time. You know, they were very game and super hilarious, and I kind of wanted to capture what they're like now. You know, there's a home movie aspect to it where,
yeah,
you know, I can capture how sweet and hilarious they are. I can capture the incredible tension between them. And then it's gone forever, and like it exists now. I have it.
Well, but the rest of the world has it too. Is there that privacy thing that's weird, or?
No, because we don't go that far, as much as it feels really far.
Right.
We are tapping into some very universal things, which is sibling rivalry, what it feels like to be a hormonal 13, 14-year-old girl, what it feels like to have your older sister kind of not want to hang out with you that much, how heartbreaking that can be,
sure. And
just having emotions which are out of control when you get to a certain age. But we have fun with it. It's not accurate in a sense that she would be embarrassed, because it's not actually the truth, but she understands it enough to create this character that is a super heightened version of things that we talk about all the time. Iris is a little bit more being herself and being really funny, and she has a lot of joy about her, but she's also kind of tough and funny. And for her, I think it really captures what her vibe was, you know, at 8 years old.
That point in her life.
Yeah. It's already changed into something else. And that's what made me feel comfortable too, which is whatever we do 2 years later, they're not even these people.
Right.
No one will even recognize them. Like, it's changing so fast. We're just capturing like a very brief moment in time.
And I think it gives you an opportunity to have to discuss all kinds of things that are going on too. Whereas if you're just sitting at home, I think we should talk about sibling rivalry. You know, that's not going to happen, and it's not going to feel authentic. Mm-hmm. But this is, you know, there's this crazy dialogue that goes along with, you know, hey, why are we making this scene? And we're making
absolutely. And I felt like after the movie was done, that Maude and Iris felt a little silly about their fights.
Uh-huh.
That their fights were so ridiculous that I could turn it into a comedy.
Right.
And that they did need to appreciate each other more. And take it easy on each other.
Or watching an audience laugh at that,
And I could say to them, you know why they're laughing? Because you're being ridiculous. Right. You should be nicer to each other.
Well, it's like that ultimate thing. Like, don't you wish that we had a tape recorder going on this fight? Because if I played it back to you, you'd see how ridiculous you're sounding.
Yeah, and it is. You don't understand why your older sibling doesn't want to hang out with you.
Right. It's universal as an adult because you've gone through it all. But as a kid in the middle of it, you don't know it's universal.
Yeah.
You think it's only happening to you.
I felt that way with my brother. How come my brother's so annoyed when I want to just tool around in his room? Like, why is he kicking me out?
Right.
I don't even get it. I thought I'm cool. You know, why doesn't he like that that one of his friends thinks I'm cool? Why is he mad that I'm developing a friendship with one of his friends? And that's what I like about that movie is I feel like, the people who appreciate it, always say, it feels like you hit a camera in my house. Like, clearly you've hidden a camera in my house. And that's the best reaction to it. Because I always thought, the more specific we get, the more universal it is.
Isn't that funny how that works? That you think if you don't do this process, that whatever you're going through is completely unique.
Yeah.
And it's not at all. And that's your goal, isn't it, in a way, is to show that the weird voice in our head is really the weird voice in everybody's head.
Yeah, everybody's having these experiences. I mean, it's, guys sneak in the bathroom and they're on their phone or their iPad too much because they're so overwhelmed from responsibility and trying to do a good job.
Right.
And, people don't talk about all of those things. There's a great Louis C.K. joke where he was talking about how he has two daughters and how much work it is, and that when he gets out of his car to walk around to open the door on the other side for them, that walk is like the most relaxing moment of his day.
I totally understand that.
And so that's, what the movie's trying to do is create these moments that people relate to. And it makes them feel better. Like, I kind of went crazy that one time, but they're going crazy in this movie. I guess every once in a while people go crazy and lose their minds and then figure out what they need to do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, God, what an amazing opportunity. And I think that it's brave. And it's also, it's brave to put your family in your film. But it seems to have worked out really well.
Yeah, it's worked out well enough that there's been no detrimental effects so far.
Right.
There's been no, daddy, you ruined my life.
Not so far.
Putting me in the movie and making me do that. That hasn't happened at all.
Right.
If I could just not ruin their life, I'm okay. I don't even need people to like it. It's just like, is your life not ruined? Okay.
Last thing. What would success be if you achieved everything you wanted to do? What level?
What would success be if I achieved everything I wanted to do? That's a very good question. I don't know. It's hard for me to say because I have a notion to make something, but I don't have any goals beyond the thing I'm trying to make. So, if an overall goal would be success would mean I'm allowed to make movies, then I feel like I've achieved that goal. At least in this moment, for a little while, they let me make movies. And then my daily goal is not to screw up the one I'm trying to do. And that's kind of it. There's not anything beyond that. Right now, I've directed these four movies and produced a bunch of movies, and I'm very proud of what I've done. And I try to think, not in terms of goals. The thing that calms me is to say, if I did nothing else, if it ended, I did all right. And that kind of calms me down. Like, you don't need to prove anything. You had some fun. So many of your dreams came true. So you should just kind of relax and be a happy person and enjoy all of it personally and professionally, as opposed to I need to win the Nobel Peace Prize. I don't really have another goal. My goals are generally emotional. Just, can I just be happy? Can I find some grace as a person? But I'm sure that would change, after a disastrous few movies and my career is about to end, and I'm sure I'd have all sorts of goals to get it back.
Well, that was the last question you asked Jerry Seinfeld.
Oh, wow.
I thought I would throw that in there. Because his answer was something about sort of a Bill Cosby-esque existence. And it's funny, I think, to ask that question at different stages in someone's life. But you're in a place where, maybe you've gone farther than you ever dreamed you would go. So, that's a hard question, right?
Well, you can't be too greedy. Right. You know, it's nice that you get to go to work and be creative and hang out with your friends and have some amount of control over it, and that's, you know, something to just be grateful for, and try to, you know, honor the opportunity to express yourself and then do it, you know, in a way that means something to people and is positive to people. You know, it sounds like BS, but really that's all there is to you know, have something that you think, you know, when people are alone watching it, something good comes of it. Well, if it's Freaks and Geeks, it helps kids get through high school. On some level, they watch it and think, oh, you can be different and it's okay. And look, they made kind of the geek kids cool. And, you know, those are the future Steve Jobs of the world. And for some people, they never heard those types of messages before. So in each movie, you know, hopefully there's something in it that makes somebody feel better.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, I am very grateful that you came and did this.
It was a pleasure.
And really just listening to this stuff, and to be in any artistic field and hear you know, your story and the way you did it, it's totally inspiring. So thanks for spending the time with me. I appreciate it.
Does my shirt look good?
Your shirt looks good.
Okay, good.
You have just finished listening to another episode of Off Camera. To access more episodes, subscribe, and be a part of the entire Off Camera experience, please visit offcamera.com. This has been a presentation of the NTD Broadcast Network.